Hello and welcome to Science World. Today we'll hear that a bacterium responsible for causing pimples has now been discovered in some grapevines. And the scientists who made the discovery have named their finding after the late music legend Frank Zappa. Several Ethiopians now living abroad have accused their own government of hacking into their computers and monitoring their private communications. One of the people involved is suing the Ethiopian government over it. There are new concerns about public health in the Indian capital of New Delhi after levels of air pollution there have reached record levels this winter. And a new report shows that while we have a high regard for science and scientists, many of us could use some help in understanding what science is all about and what scientists do. We'll talk with the researcher who wrote the report. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Scientists have discovered grapevines have been carrying the bacteria that cause pimples. Named for the late musical legend Frank Zappa, scientists say it's the first time a bacterium found in humans has been discovered taking up residence all the way across the tree of life in plants. Steve Barragona reports.
Molecular biologist Omar Rotas-Tabelli and colleagues were studying microbes living inside grapevines.
Yeah, there's plenty of bacteria living inside the plants. And we know some are good bacteria for the plants, some other are bad.
But speaking by Skype from Italy's Fondazione Edmund Mach, he said they were surprised to find that all the grapevines they studied harbored bacteria usually found on human skin and best known for causing acne. Human-associated bacteria may occasionally turn up on plants. Think of E. coli that contaminate produce and cause disease outbreaks. But Rotas-Tabelli says they usually don't live in plants.
We never witnessed, to our knowledge, to a fully transfer from human to a plant. And especially because this bacteria seems perfectly now used to stay in the grapevine. Can't live without grape.
The bacteria don't give the grapevines or the fruit acne. At this point, it's not clear what they're doing to or for the plant. Writing in the journal Molecular Biology and Evolution, Rotas-Tabelli says the microbes appear to have first moved into grapevines around 7,000 years ago.
7,000 of years is perfectly matched when human domesticated the grape. So it made really, really sense.
Tending grapevines involves a lot of cutting, he adds, opening up a route for the bacteria to move in. When they first discovered acne in their grapevines, Rotas-Tabelli says,
my impression as well was that's a contamination from the technician, no way.
When further tests confirmed the more ancient transmission, they named the bacteria P. acnes type Zappae, after Frank Zappa, the guitar virtuoso known for such songs as My Guitar Wants to Kill Your Mama and Don't Eat the Yellow Snow.
The deadly yellow snow from right there where the huskies go.
Rotas-Tabelli says he and lead author Andrea Campisano are fans, but it's more than that.
I think we behaved in a Frank Zappa way, I think, because instead of the usual explanation, like a contamination, like everybody would think about, we fought in a different way and found something very unexpected.
Great googly moogly!
Rotas-Tabelli says the next step is to look inside other plants to see if P. zappae turns up in more unexpected places.
The deadly yellow snow crystal.
Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Of his sight. And he stood up and he looked around and he said,
Several Ethiopians living abroad are accusing their home government of using sophisticated computer spyware to hack into their computers and monitor their private communications. Peter Heinlein has this report.
The Ethiopian native, who is a U.S. citizen, charges that agents used a program called FinSpy to monitor his emails, Skype calls, and his web browsing history. A suit filed in federal district court in Washington Tuesday asked that Ethiopia be named as being behind the cyber attacks and to pay damages of $10,000. The suit includes an affidavit asking that the plaintiff's name be kept secret. Attorney Richard Martinez of the law firm Robbins, Kaplan, Miller & Cerisi helped to prepare the suit. He tells VOA the unusual request for anonymity was made because the individual fears that he and family members still in Ethiopia could be in danger if he is identified.
We have petitioned the court to proceed anonymously because this individual is very active within the Ethiopian diaspora community. And we think the actions taken by the Ethiopian government against him illustrate exactly the attention they've placed on him and the danger that exists for him.
The suit is the latest in a series of cyber spying accusations against the Addis Ababa government. In another case, an Ethiopian refugee in London is asking British police to investigate evidence that FinSpy software known as FinFisher was used to hack his computer. Tadesse Kersmo, who identified himself as a member of the executive committee of the Ethiopian opposition group Ginbot 7, filed a complaint Monday asking for a probe of Gamma Group, a company that produces the FinFisher software. Tadesse Kersmo told a news conference he became suspicious after files from his computer began appearing on the Internet and found evidence it had been infected with FinSpy. Much of the evidence linking Ethiopia to cyber spying has been developed by a Canadian organization called Citizen Lab. Bill Marchak, a researcher for Citizen Lab, told VOA investigators first linked Ethiopia to cyber spyware nearly a year ago. Marchak says Citizen Lab's investigation has also led it to an Italian firm called Hacking Team, which has been labeled by the press freedom group Reporters Without Borders on a list of what are called corporate enemies. A Citizen Lab report released this month suggests that Hacking Team software has been used to spy on U.S.-based journalists from Ethiopia. Ethiopian Foreign Ministry spokesman Dina Mufti told VOA his government does not engage in computer hacking.
There is a freedom of speech. There is everyone is entitled to his opinion. And that is something that is at the core of our rules and procedures. There is a freedom of expression. And the hacking business is not our business. As to the allegations the journalists are coming with, I'm not sure. I cannot say anything now.
Marchak says evidence has been found linking cyber software supplied by Hacking Team and FinSpy to more than a dozen countries, including Ethiopia, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, and Bahrain. A Hacking Team policy statement posted on the Internet says the company understands the potential for abuse of the surveillance technologies they produce and takes precautions to limit that potential. Peter Heinlein, VOA News, Washington.
Since we just heard about a case involving the alleged use of spyware, for today's quick quiz, we'd like to see if you know the name that Microsoft and others use for any software designed to cause damage to a single computer, server, or computer network. Is it A, Trojan, B, Virus, C, Malware, or D, Spyware? Think you know the right answer? Well, we'll find out in a few minutes from now when we reveal the correct answer.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
In the Indian capital, New Delhi, levels of air pollution hit a new high this winter, triggering concerns about its adverse impact on public health and particularly on children. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
Pediatrician Sanjeev Bagai sees about 50 children every day at a hospital in an upscale market area in New Delhi. He says nearly half his young patients suffer from respiratory and chest infections related to air pollution. He calls the situation alarming.
The numbers have doubled. These children who grow up with COPD, that is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, die earlier. They're predisposed towards heart disease. Neurological problems.
During a decade of economic growth, Delhi has added more cars than any other Indian city, many of them using diesel, a more polluting fuel. Today, the Indian capital has a staggering 7.5 million vehicles, choking not just its roads, but also its air. Anumita Roy Chowdhury, executive director at New Delhi Center for Science and Environment, says in just 5 years, levels of particulate matter, which penetrates deep into the lungs, has gone up by 75%. The situation worsens in winter when it is less windy and a mixture of fog, car exhausts, soot and dust shrouds the city in grey smog. Roy Chowdhury says this winter the situation absolutely exploded.
Throughout the winter, the data showed that the levels were 2 to 3 times higher than the standards, and the higher ranges reached up to 4 to 7 times the standards. And when we had the special smog episodes when things were very bad, then the levels could even hit 8 to 10 times the standards. It was literally a blanket of smog. And this is scary.
The high air pollution levels have triggered a debate on whether Delhi's air has become dirtier than that of the Chinese capital, Beijing, which has long been under scrutiny for its dismal air quality among the world's big cities. Delhi's comparisons with Beijing began after a study by Yale and Columbia University ranked India at 174 out of 178 countries in air quality. Environmentalists say, what counts is not whether Delhi's air is more polluted than that of the Chinese capital, but whether the Indian capital is doing enough to tackle a fast-growing problem. Anumita Roy Chowdhury is a member of a state body appointed to draft measures to deal with the pollution. She says while Beijing has taken a wide range of actions to tackle the problem, Delhi has not. Beijing has limited the number of cars that can be sold in the city. It has scaled up public transport and issues health advisories on bad days. An action plan formed to tackle air pollution has languished for nearly 2 years. Meanwhile, Delhi's toxic air extracts a heavy price on public health. The World Health Organization says that air pollution is the fifth highest killer in India, and the country has the world's highest death rate because of chronic respiratory problems. And several studies show that the worst impact is on the city's children, whose immune systems are less developed than that of adults. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
A new leak of highly radioactive water has been discovered at Japan's stricken Fukushima nuclear power plant. Science World's Bob Doty has more.
Tokyo Electric Power Company, which operates the Fukushima plant, revealed Thursday that 100 tons of contaminated water leaked from a storage tank at the facility. A TEPCO spokesman said the leak had been stopped and that it is unlikely any of the water reached the sea, which is 700 meters away. Masayuki Ono, an official from TEPCO, said that they have been able to determine where the leak is taking place and that it's far from the ocean. The TEPCO official also commented that they don't think that any of the radioactive water has made it to the ocean. He said the leak occurred because two valves on the storage tank were mistakenly left open and another malfunctioned. It is one of hundreds of storage tanks containing water used to cool melted down reactors that were hit by a tsunami and earthquake in 2011. Repeated leaks of contaminated water have been reported at the plant. TEPCO admitted last year that some was flowing into the ocean. TEPCO says decommissioning the entire Fukushima complex could take 30 to 40 years. For Science World, this is Bob Doty.
Bees pollinate 3/4 of the world's food crops, but now food security is at risk because bee populations around the world are declining due to a complex set of factors. Roseanne Skirbel tells us about a new study that finds honeybees from colonies that are managed by beekeepers may be infecting their wild bumblebee cousins with disease.
While honeybees and bumblebees come from the same bee family, the smaller honeybees live in managed hives, which beekeepers move from farm to farm to pollinate crops and produce honey. Bumblebees live in much smaller colonies in the wild. Both get pollen from the same flowers and crops, which is how they come into contact. Study co-author Matthias First of Royal Holloway University of London says lab experiments show that bumblebees suffer from the same parasites, pathogens, and disease as honeybees.
For that, we infected bees and checked their infection status and their longevity, and we found a significant reduction in their longevity. So these pathogens are really infective and really impact our bee population.
Bumblebees' lifespans were shortened by 25% to 33%, reducing the amount of food they could provide to their colonies. Co-author Mark Brown, also with Royal Holloway University, says that loss is greater for bumblebees because their colonies or family groups are much smaller than honeybees' hives.
While honeybees, you know, may have anywhere up to 50,000 workers, say, in a hive, losing one worker is not a big problem. Bumblebees, depending upon the species, live in groups of anywhere between a few tens to a few hundreds of workers. And so every worker you lose or whose life is shortened is going to have a much larger impact on the colony, its survival, and its reproduction.
First says his team then checked infections in both managed and wild bee populations across England.
And what we find here is that the disease or the pathogens are widespread in the landscape, that honeybees have much higher prevalence levels at pretty much all of those sites as compared to bumblebees, which was one of the reasons why we think the transmission is really going in this direction, honeybees to bumblebees and not the other way around.
Viral infection is triggered by a common parasite, the varroa mite, that spreads rapidly in beehives. Co-author Brown says methods exist to control the mites to some extent, but they remain a tricky problem.
Because most of our controls are based on chemicals, and the mites can evolve resistance to those chemicals. And so we need coordinated control strategies, but also the development of new control strategies that are going to be effective in the long term.
Brown hopes their study, published in the journal Nature, focuses greater attention not only on managed pollinators, but also on the services provided by their wild counterparts.
And we need to think about how we managed honeybees, not just from the perspective of looking after them, but potentially from the perspective of looking after our wild bees too.
Brown adds that the sample infection numbers are conservative, so overall infection rates are most likely higher, underscoring the critical need for more work to protect the pollinators. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Well, do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Let's find out. A few minutes ago, we asked if you knew the word that Microsoft and others used to refer to any software that was designed to cause damage to a single computer, server, or computer network. Is it A, Trojan, B, virus, C, malware, or D, spyware? The answer is C. Malware is the word that is considered to be the catch-all term for all types of harmful software, such as trojans, worms, viruses, spyware, adware, and others. Malware is short for malicious software that's been specifically created to disrupt the operation of a computer or network. Those who write or deploy the malware may use the rogue software to find and gather private and sensitive information that may be stored on someone's computer or computer network. Malware can even be used to gain access and control of private computer systems and networks, including those that belong to governments and corporations. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
According to a new survey, Americans, like others in many parts of the world, have a true respect for science and scientists. And they say that they're really interested in learning all about the latest scientific breakthroughs. But unfortunately, Americans, again, just like people in other parts of the world, can use some tutoring to better learn and understand science. This bit of insight into what the American public thinks and knows about science was included in a new report from the National Science Board, the governing body of the National Science Foundation. John Besley from Michigan State University reviewed the survey data and was the lead author of the section of the report that examined the public perceptions of science and technology. Dr. Pesley joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about the results of the survey and how Americans' attitudes and knowledge about science compares with people in other parts of the world. First of all, what do Americans in general think about science?
Americans in general have a pretty high level of interest in science. It's right up there, especially medical science, with some other topics. And I think they have pretty high levels of confidence in scientists. And I think a lot of the coverage of the report is focused on what they may or may not know. But, I mean, for me, that's been pretty stable over all these years and since about the 1980s. I think it's also great to see that Americans remain confident in science.
Let's talk about knowledge of science. How are Americans as far as understanding science?
They're right about with everybody else in the world, it turns out. You know, it's easy to get frustrated that they don't know, you know, certain scientific facts, but we hope that it'll go up, and we track these things over a long period of time because our hope is that they'll change over time. It's not going down, so that's good, but it's not going up, and I think there's lots of great folks out there who are trying to figure out ways to move the needle a little bit on the science knowledge. It's right there with the rest of the world.
Tell us about the survey itself. Who was involved, and what did it ask?
It's a project that the National Science Board, which is the group that runs the National Science Foundation, a series of indicators that they do every 2 years. In this case, it's part of, they include these survey questions as part of what's called the General Social Survey, which is really one of the world's best surveys. It's face-to-face, it's more than 2,000 respondents, really high response rate, 71%, which is just, you know, just amazing for surveys. And then there's questions about interest, there's questions about knowledge, and then there's questions about general attitudes towards science.
Along with checking and analyzing the data in the survey, you also checked out similar surveys from other countries. And you briefly mentioned this a little earlier, but how do the Americans stack up against the rest of the world?
It would be lovely if we had data from all the countries in the world. We have data from a few countries, Europe in particular, and some countries in Asia have been doing surveys in this area. And I think it seems like, you know, there's always a couple countries that sort of pop out ahead maybe on certain questions, but then, you know, the U.S. is right there either doing fairly well relatively or at least around the average.
Now, these other surveys that you looked at, did they also include general population's knowledge of science?
Yeah, there's a whole sort of lot of different governments, a lot of organizations track this data over time. Science is so important to how our society works that there's a big interest in making sure that we keep track of how people feel about science and how they what they think about science.
As you were analyzing the survey data, did you come across any surprises?
I'm so surprised with just how stable science is compared to some of the other things. If you look at, for example, confidence, the group that Americans have the highest confidence in is the military. But that's bumped around over the years. It's been low and it's been high, and right now it's fairly high. Medical profession is sort of the next group that they have pretty high levels of confidence in. But that's been sort of slowly sort of coming down over the years. But science is different. Science has sort of stayed fairly stable since, you know, the 1980s in terms of how much confidence they have, but also how much interest Americans have.
As you finish up the analyzation of this data, what impressions did you take away from your work regarding the public's perception of science?
I think we're really fortunate in the United States that Americans continue to have a fairly high level of confidence in science. They want their kids to go into science. They see science in all kinds of different parts of their lives. At the same time, you know, I study science communication, so I think there's also an opportunity to improve how people think about science and what people know about science. And I think there's lots of people out there who are trying to do that. One of the really positive things is compared to other countries, Americans go to science museums, science aquariums, zoos more than most people in other countries. And I think that really bodes well for Americans' continued interest in science and technology.
One number that I noticed was regarding funding.
About 80% of Americans see a need for the government to continue to fund scientific research. There's lots of other areas Americans want funding for. And so science doesn't necessarily pop out as the thing they want more funding for, but it's there and it's sort of creeped up since the 1980s that people are saying that there's too little funding for science.
And finally, Professor, I'm curious, what kind of feedback have you been getting on these results?
Most people comment on the knowledge questions, and I think that's normal. It's easy to look at the knowledge questions and, you know, shake your head. But I think the confidence elements is something that people are happy about, and I think scientists want to make sure that they keep that confidence and do the things that it takes to maintain confidence in science.
That was John Pesley, an associate professor of advertising and public relations at Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.